Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And I am Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we welcome you here on this Monday as we spend a great deal of time talking about our energy future, what happened in the Gulf, and what's happening in the Gulf at this moment. We are joined now. Richard Charter remains with us. He is government relations consultant for the Defenders of Wildlife Action Fund. Mike Olson is joining us, counsel in Bracewell and Giuliani Environmental Strategies Group in Washington, D.C., and worked for 5 years in the Department of the Interior under George W. Bush. Mike Olson, welcome back to the show. It's been a while. It's good to have you back with us.
Hi, thank you. It's good to be here.
And John Hiskis joins us. Yes, on the screen. He's there. staff writer for grist.org. And John, welcome back. Good to have you with us as well.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
And Richard, thank you so much for staying with us.
Thank you.
And you all can join us out there at 410-319-8888 as we jump into this conversation. Let me ask, this clearly is going to become a political battle over the next whatever period of time it's going to take. Where we think this is going to go, we hear a lot from environmentalists and environmental groups and groups who want to develop new, clean, green energy, that we cannot have any more drilling. This became a presidential campaign battle when the former Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, now Chairman of the Republican Party, Michael Steele, got up there and said, drill, baby, drill, and it became one of the mantras of the Republican campaign. Everybody thinks Giuliani said it, but it wasn't Giuliani. Actually, Michael Steele said it first. But the question is now remains, with one-third of our oil coming from local sources, one-third of the oil of those sources coming out of the Gulf, 35,000 people employed in that industry, that the argument of whether we need to drill now more, we're talking about all the way down the East Coast and around into the Gulf, once this is done, President Obama has given no indication that he will not continue to pursue offshore drilling. And others are arguing that we should be doing wind instead and finding other ways of dealing with this and other kind of ways of cutting back on our energy use. And that this is the debate that's going to rage. So let's leap into this. Let's start off with Richard, then we'll go to Mike Olson. If you would kind of start where you think this debate's going to take us.
Well, it's even more impossible to predict the direction of the debate than it is the direction of the spill. But I would suggest that it's a safe assumption that existing offshore drilling in U.S. waters will not be shut down. I think it's also a reasonable assumption that existing offshore drilling in U.S. waters will be under more strict safety scrutiny by the government. I certainly think a lot of Americans hope so, and that companies will take due precautionary measures to make sure nothing like this ever happens again. But it is, and members of Congress from these same Gulf Coast states have been, with the exception of Florida, generally been supportive of this industry going forward in the Gulf. So I don't see a U-turn on drilling from existing leases and existing rigs. I think that it will be under a microscope from here on out once we have this spill stopped. As far as opening new areas on, let's say, the Pacific coast and the Atlantic coast and places in Alaska that are, even more sensitive and where cleaning up a spill would be impossible because of broken sea ice, well, it's impossible even in the Gulf, but more impossible in the Arctic, I think we need to take a second look at those areas. It is the case that a bipartisan consensus in Congress for 27 years protected the Pacific coast and the Atlantic coast and parts of the Florida Gulf Coast from new drilling. That has been in place for 27 years and ended as a result of the Drill Baby Drill public relations campaign on October 1st, 2008. And, of course, three consecutive presidents, Bush Sr. and Clinton and Bush Jr., actually had executive measures in place to protect the Pacific and Atlantic coast. So I think opening up new areas now may be a little more problematic from a policy standpoint.
Now, Mike Olson, what do you think about the idea of reversing the 27 years and opening up, as the debate will continue, debate will begin on the Atlantic coast, the Pacific coast, and the Gulf?
Well, clearly there's going to be some increased debate about it in light of the Deepwater Horizon tragedy. There's no question about that. What's important, I think, to remember, however, is when the congressional moratorium was in place and the executive withdrawal was in place, that had been in place, you know, from the congressional standpoint since the early 80s, and then later on with the executive withdrawal, we weren't dealing with a situation where we were staring down the barrel of paying, you know, $4 a gallon for gasoline. And so when President Bush, during the last administration, removed the executive withdrawal, and Congress was called upon by the president to remove the congressional moratorium, I think the political winds had changed to some degree, because we were, you know, the price of a gallon of gasoline had shot up through the roof. It was the summertime. People were aware of the amount that they were going to be having to pay for their, you know, their family vacations. And I think, you know, not only did the president recognize that, but the democratically controlled Congress recognized that same issue, knowing full well that, you know, we wouldn't necessarily be able to meet all of our oil and gas needs by opening up all of the entirety of the Outer Continental Shelf to oil and gas development, but it would indeed make an impact, and a necessary impact, when we were looking at the cost of oil and gas and considering how much money we were sending overseas.
John Hiskus, let me let you weigh on this. We'll throw some targeted questions in here about this. John?
I'm sorry?
Sure. Obviously, this, you know, could have a big impact on the offshore drilling industry, making, you know, things different for both existing rigs and potential new ones. But if the end result of this, if all we accomplish is that, you know, we do less domestic drilling and pipe in more oil from Canada and ship in more oil from rigs elsewhere in the world and from countries that have fewer safeguards for their environment and their workers, then we're not really accomplishing much. We're just sort of shifting the, you know, the burden elsewhere, and our basic fossil fuel addiction is still the same. And what's interesting to me is this, you know, one of the things that we have in the Gulf is a visible symbol of the toxic slick of carbon dioxide that's spreading through the atmosphere, that's every bit as damaging to the oceans and to just about everything else, and that, you know, there's almost an opportunity here that, you know, this is a visible reminder of just, you know, how problematic a relationship with fossil fuels is. So that's the more interesting question to me is, you know, what do we do about the overall problem?
Well, so let me ask the three of this question then. I mean, this disaster is seen by some as an opportunity, but seen very differently in different places. Some see this as an opportunity to create greater regulation on the development of oil rigs to pump more oil for America. Others see this as a opportunity to advance in the top of this tragedy, and this can be a very severe tragedy, many people think. We'll see over the next weeks how this plays out, but this tragedy to say no more drilling, not one more rig built in America, and let's start investing our money into other forms of energy and other ways of realizing energy independence. Now, this is where the debate's going to rage, I think, in the Senate, the House, but more and maybe in a larger way in the body politic in America. So talk about how that where you see the debate going. Mike Olson, then we'll go to Richard, and then John.
Well, I think the American people understand that we are forever going to be dependent to some degree on fossil fuels. We are going to continue to drive cars. We're going to continue to need to power our homes. You know, the oil and gas that comes from the Gulf of Mexico is a tremendous boost to the U.S. economy. I completely agree. I think it is absolutely necessary to develop all of the resources that we have to bring to bear, whether that's wind, geothermal, solar, and oil and gas. I don't think anybody would argue that we shouldn't do everything we can in order to make ourselves less dependent on foreign oil. But I don't think we're going to get to a point where we can say that we are not going to need to use conventional fuels. I just don't see that we're going to get to that point. Now, whether whether, you know, people are going to get to a point where they will say, you know, we're not going to support any sort of expanded development, I think remains to be seen in light of this current this current tragedy and the ongoing spill cleanup. But I think that the American people recognize that we are not going to be able to completely wean ourselves off of oil and gas.
I'm just curious, and I know that Mark wants Richard and John to answer that question, but I'm very curious. We keep talking about our addiction to fossil fuels. We keep talking about leadership in Congress. We keep talking about the energy bill. Does anyone, Richard or John, do you believe that the Democrats who now control both houses of Congress will use this as an opportunity to ratchet up the requirements in this energy bill, that we move a little higher in addressing our fossil fuel addictions?
They haven't shown signals that they're going to do that yet, and the reason is they don't feel the need to, they don't feel the pressure yet. You know, there's a lot of people that are, I think, saying privately they're ready for something else, and they sense the big potential clean energy investments, but they're not demanding it from lawmakers yet. Lawmakers, you know, do know the money they're getting from fossil fuel industries, you know, that's very clear. And, you know, as long as that's easier to measure and sense and, you know, pressure from their constituents, it's going to be a while before they really change direction on that. And, as of the first couple of weeks of, you know, this disaster, it's not clear that congressional Democrats are going to change their plan on that.
Richard?
Well, I would have to very respectfully disagree with Mike's statement that we will be forever dependent on fossil fuels. The U.S. controls at a maximum 3 to 4, maybe if we find a lot more, 5% of the global reserves. And we're consuming about 25% of the world production. So that is an equation, just do the math. Dependency on fossil fuels going forward is not going to work out. We can't influence the price at the pump by domestic drilling, onshore or offshore. And so that kind of leads us back to 1976, I would suggest, when Jimmy Carter walked out wearing a sweater in front of a fireplace and said, energy conservation is the moral equivalent of war. Now, not very many people listened to him at that point. But I would suggest that this administration, if it wanted to respond once the leak is shut in, I mean, the first thing is national attention should be stopping this runaway blowout. After that, there are so many opportunities for painless conservation and energy efficiency that would require no noticeable change in lifestyle in this country, just cleaning up the power grid so it's not pumping heat out of every switchyard and substation. All the way down to things in our homes every day that could be much more efficient. It seems to me that there is an opportunity in this tragedy. Unfortunately, every tragedy seems to present opportunities. But it's going to be hard, I think, to sell the American people on clean, safe, accident-free offshore drilling for quite some time after this event.
So, and if that's the case, I mean, I wonder, Mike Olson, I mean, why you think we'll never get away from fossil fuels in our lifetime or in the future? I mean, if you think also politically, I mean, some of this offshore drilling in West Africa and what happened in Kyrgyzstan are kind of fueling some of the worst of the regimes on the planet to boot. So, I mean, what do you think?
Well, you make an interesting point there. I mean, fueling some of the worst regimes on the planet, we are sending our money over to some of the worst regimes on the planet, which is why I think it's necessary for us to develop and drill for our own reserves. Now, look, I completely agree, and I agree with the president. It needs to be done safely. It needs to be done in an environmentally secure and an environmentally friendly manner, but you make a very good point that where we're sending money over to regimes that don't particularly care for us, we're funding these things. To me, it seems to make the most sense to do everything we can on our own soil to make ourselves less dependent on those energy resources of those other countries. And I completely agree. Energy efficiency is necessary. The development of renewable resources is necessary. And certainly this administration has taken great strides to do that. I mean, look at the recent announcement regarding Cape Wind. That's a great step in the right direction. But while we are in a situation right now where we are having to send money and resources overseas, I think, to me personally, and I think a lot of people, the American people would agree that we need to do everything we can to develop as much of our own resources as we can.
So what
and
would
that
be? I'm sorry.
Oil and gas.
I'm sorry, Mike, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I'm sorry. I was just, and that includes oil and gas on our own lands.
Now, I'd like to hear the Richard and Charter and John Hiskus talk about how you think we can do without oil and gas. I mean, I was thinking about that this morning. I mean, here I'm driving my car into work. We have no public transit of any note that I could just jump on and get to where I have to go. We don't have rail. That we are, everything we do, whether it's electricity or anything else, is all built on fossil fuels. There's a huge debate in Maryland now about whether or not we should build a transmission line from Western Maryland to the Eastern Shore and down through Southern Maryland. So, I mean, what is the reasonable alternative for people to think about it if, in fact, you think there is one? How do you even begin to get there, John Hiskus?
Well, Richard's right that energy efficiency is the low-hanging fruit that no one in their right mind can really disagree with. And, you know, Mike mentioned, too, that he agrees that, you know, there's hundreds of ways that we could, you know, be using our energy more smartly, both in our buildings and in our vehicles and at different points in the electricity infrastructure that, you know, combined, they would save more than we're getting from offshore drilling. They would save us money and they would create jobs. So there's no reason that for Congress not to act on that. The second thing is putting a price on carbon dioxide pollution is the one lever that's big enough to get to everything else and to trickle down into every decision that people and businesses make. And there's different ways to do that, but it's cap and trade and cap and dividend are they're plans that people have opinions about, but they also respond. And in the summer of 2008, when gas hit $4 a gallon and more, people changed their behavior and they figured out pretty quickly they didn't need to drive multi-ton military-sized vehicles to the grocery store to pick up a gallon of milk. Things like that. When you factor the full cost of oil and coal into their pricing, that changes a lot.
And Richard, I mean, one of the things was said to me recently by somebody who's is huge in the investment world, not on this program but off the air, was that, look, nobody is going to invest in wind and solar and bring it to market because, A, we don't have the transmission lines to make it work. We can't get the wind from one place to the other. And, B, unless America is willing to put a price on oil and price on fossil fuels, we'll never make the money back we want to make back on wind and solar.
Well, two things there. You say the wind's in the wrong place and we need to transmit the energy to where it's needed. We've had at least 25 years of warning that we were going to need to figure out how to do that. And we could certainly, I think, if we can bring the Apollo 13 capsule back for the moon, on a shoestring, we could certainly build power lines across this country that are needed to transmit renewables to end users. I mean, to me, that's just a matter of deciding to do it. You said that we need to gradually wean ourselves off of oil, and I think that is the case. And we have known that since the 70s, that eventually we were going to need to do that, and that carbon-based fuels are, they're kind of attractive. You have a lot of energy at a small volume of transportable fuel. That's kind of hard to get away from, but if you recognize that they are finite, ultimately, whether they end this century or the next, it would be a seemingly good idea to use non-renewable resources to create sustainable renewable sources while we have the chance. And we've kind of blown about 30 years here when we knew it was possible but didn't do it. And to me, the model is corporate fuel efficiency standards in the Congress and the experience with that over the last, 17 years or so, where Detroit every year would kill more efficient vehicle standards. Maybe they weren't always written perfectly, but Detroit fought back more efficient U.S. automobiles. The result of that was that manufacturers of automobiles from other countries made more efficient automobiles, so they sold them, and Detroit ultimately nearly went bankrupt, or in some cases did go bankrupt. So if we could learn from that, I think we would see that just making the whole society more efficient without changing the lifestyle is something that is within the realm of possibility, particularly with some of these new technologies, LEDs and other things that, solid-state transmission facilities. We have the technology, and we're running out of time to apply it. And we're seeing today, unfortunately, on every television set in America, that offshore drilling does have with it environmental costs. Some of the environmental costs of carbon dependency, of course, are not visible here, but they are invisible in the Arctic, and they have to do with global climate change. But we are not on a course to correct ourselves. In other words, all the warning signs are going off, but we're not changing. We're saying, drill, baby, drill. And out of this, I think, could come some very constructive changes of direction, ultimately.
Let's try to get a caller in here. 410-319-8888 is the number. And William in Mount Washington, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, we can, William.
Thanks for calling, William.
Okay, good afternoon. Pretty much my observation, just from listening to the panel and people talking, pretty much I feel that fuel companies just don't care, really. It's about dollars and cents, and I'm agreeing with the other gentleman, is drill, baby, drill. I mean, we had the coal miners in West Virginia, died of gas. You know, they pretty much blowing off tops of mountains, drilling deep down in the earth's crust, drilling places probably that they shouldn't be drilling in. It, like I said, it kills our fish. It basically stops other people from making money, the people that was making money off the Louisiana estuary. So I'm thinking, from all this peeing and begging and all these environmental, I know these fuel companies know that these people are here and they have valid reasons to say what they say. But I truthfully don't think that they care. And it's, I know the movie, was it Chevron, where they dropped all the oil in that country in South America, and the people had to plea, and they still didn't quite make a clear decision to give those people back the money from basically killing the indigenous population through poison. So it's just going to be something. We have all these intellectual people in America, and we can put a ship on the moon. But we can't come up with a clear decision on, like the gentleman said, we had 30 years to come up with some type of solution to make it to where we can have a better environment, but at
okay.
the same time get fuel, So that's pretty much my comment. Thank you.
No, I hear you. And so, Mike Olson, that's a growing segment of America that you just heard in the voice of William in Washington. So how would you respond in terms of the track record of big oil on this planet and the idea that people want to get away from fossil fuels for global warming and many other reasons?
Well, I thought I understood him to say that oil companies don't care.
He did say that.
And I would have to disagree with the caller on that point. The oil companies do care. I think that the track record demonstrates that they care. There is a lot of investment, a lot of money that goes into the development of new cutting-edge technology for purposes of developing oil and gas on the OCS, on the Outer Continental Shelf, for example. That is incredibly that is environmentally friendly. That is safe. Now, this particular incident, clearly, the oil spilling into the Gulf of Mexico. Is a tragedy. It's unfortunate. We can't forget the fact, I think on your previous segment, you read through the names of the individuals who were killed on the rig, which
right.
is incredibly tragic. I will say that the oil, as far as I can tell, the oil companies, BP and others have stepped up. Other companies that weren't involved in this particular incident have stepped up and are assisting with the cleanup. I think right now all efforts are on containment of this. And one thing that I wanted to point out too that was raised that kind of sparked something that was when it was raised before is that there's discussion about the environmental harm that maybe the distaste for offshore oil and gas development or potentially even onshore because it's dirty or people don't like it or for whatever reason. It's interesting to point out that people really like renewable energy, especially when it's a slogan on a bumper sticker. I mean, everybody likes wind, everybody likes solar, everybody likes geothermal. But when it comes time to put the shovel in the ground or put the turbines up or to build these projects, there is a significant amount, depending on where they are, of opposition, whether people don't want to look at the wind turbines on the horizon, whether they don't want to have to see the solar arrays, whether there's impacts to species. I mean, there is no energy, I think, that is free from some level of criticism by the general populace.
Mike, closing very powerful statements. I've got to come back and make this a major debate for an entire hour with you, but I'd like to give Richard Charter in the last minute and a half that we have to close out with your response.
What we saw on the deepwater horizon and are continually experiencing day-to-day now, this expanding slick, this was state-of-the-art, new cutting-edge technology that had been billed as environmentally friendly. Remember, BP changed their logo to Beyond Petroleum and tried to associate themselves with a greenwashing approach to corporate responsibility. Even on the best technology, things can go wrong and do go wrong. And what we're learning is the scale of the accident can be so large that it has economic consequences, never mind the environmental consequences for a moment. This is $14 billion now and counting is the estimate for these states that are in the path of this slick. So I think we need to sort of rebalance here a little bit and look at when things go wrong, they really go wrong, and they go wrong on a very big scale, even from modern state-of-the-art drilling rigs.
We are out of time on this segment. I really appreciate Richard Charter for staying with us this entire time. Mike Holston, good to have you back on the show with us. We're looking forward to having you all back very soon. John Hiskus, thanks for doing the work you do at Grist, and we look forward to having you back as well.
Sure.
Anthony McCarthy. We're going to come right back.
We'll be right back, and we're going to continue this conversation.
Very. And it was some other guests. We'll continue this on. And also, by the end of that half an hour, we're also going to reread the names of those whose lives were lost on that rig, not to forget that.
And late in the segment, in the next hour, we'll be joined by former Governor Robert Ehrlich to talk about his race to reclaim the State House.
I'm Mark Steiner with Anthony McCarthy on WEAA Baltimore. Stay with us.